Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport. Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I am Terry Foy. Once again, we are talking about how recruiting works, and this time we are doing it with St. Joseph's head coach, Taylor Ray. Coach Ray, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Terry, it's my pleasure. Happy to be here. Excited to chat.
No doubt. So obviously recruiting is the lifeblood of any program, and everybody goes about it differently. It starts with the evaluation. You got to figure out which players you like, and then it blossoms into a process that's not unlike dating. I've heard it described as sometimes speed dating. But let's start with that evaluation part, because that's the nuances that always really intrigue me. How do you describe yourself, and how do you describe your staff as evaluators?
That's interesting way to think about things. How do I describe myself as a recruiter? I think the first thing that I'm drawn to is overall athleticism. I think that there's kind of a level of athleticism that you're looking for to be able to compete at the highest level. So that's probably the first thing that I'm drawn to. But you can't just be a good athlete. You need to be a skilled player, an intelligent player. And the nice thing about our game is there's not like a one-size-fits-all for every position. You know, you look at football, and if you're going to be a lineman, you got to be this big, weigh this much, be able to move this fast, and so on. If you want to play a different position, then there's a mold for that. I think the neat thing about lacrosse is, you know, the skill of the game and your understanding of the game, you can play all the different positions at different sizes, at different skill levels, at different levels of athleticism. You know, you can be a sturdily built, really shifty and quick defenseman who's got a big-time motor and a pit bull type of attitude who can cover anybody out there. You know, and you could be 5'9 and 175 pounds and be great at the position. You know, you can be an attackman who's 6'3 and 215 like Levi Anderson, or you could be a smaller, shiftier vision guy like a Jeff Teat. So first thing I'm drawn to is athleticism. Then I kind of break it down by skill and how they play the position. And the third thing for me is definitely the compete level. Like, you notice the guys that play with the most energy, that get the most excited for their teammates, that are the most vocal on the field, that just flat out play the hardest. And my feeling is those guys tend to continue an upward trajectory in college if they're super competitive and tough. And guys who lack that tend to kind of like, you know, they peter out a little bit when they can't just rely on God-given talent.
I want to drill down on that a little bit, because I also tend to shade toward or have a bias toward athleticism as the first thing, right? You know, if you're creating the decision tree, it's is he athletic enough or not? And what I wonder about is that, so if that's your point of view, and there are only two factors that led to having that point of view, I'm sure that there are more, but just assume for the sake of the question that there are only two. What percentage is informed by who you were as a player, and what percentage is informed by how your experience has developed as a coach?
For people who know me as a player, I was always, I'm a big guy. I'm not the fastest guy out there, but I was a pretty good athlete. And so I think I'm drawn to guys who are bigger, stronger, faster. You know, that was kind of RMO when I was in school. But one of the things I learned through my college career is that will only get you so far if you don't have the skill and the slickness and the rest of it. So I think I'm drawn to that just because that's naturally who I am. I love the weight room. I love training. I love practice. I love footwork and all of that stuff. In terms of the, what was the question, the percentage?
Yeah, no, you kind of already answered it. I mean, I interpret that answer to be like at least 51% or more is based on what you felt like allowed you to play at the level that you were able to attain. And you know, what you have experienced as a coach, right, in your prior stops and now as the head coach at St. Joe's informs 49 or less percent, you know, based on that being kind of your predisposition.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But the 49% that you're trying to figure out in terms of the skill and the compete level and the drive and the motivation and all of that, they're not much more than a 1% difference one way or the other. You know, and I believe my staff, certainly the offensive guys, they might care less about some of those things if someone is a really smart player, or they know how to use their body, or they've got great stick work and vision and all of that stuff. So I think we have a good balance here in the office where, you know, my offensive coordinator, Scott Meehan, he loves like the slick lacrosse players. And I'm always kind of questioning him. Is this kid athletic enough to get the job done? Is he going to be able to challenge a matchup? And he'll come back and be like, we're not going to ask him to challenge a matchup. He's going to be the guy who receives the ball once the defense is in rotation. And he's going to be the guy who picks the defense apart, who makes the right reads and, you know, moves into the right gaps to continue rotations. Like, not everybody on your team needs to be able to win a matchup. And as a defensive coach, I guess you're kind of like, well, that's great. I love it when we play teams that don't need to win matchups. That makes our life a little bit easier defensively. But there's a balance there on, do they have enough guys who can win matchups and force rotations and create double teams and so on to get the ball moving and force the defense into precarious situations.
So the last question, kind of about how your experience informs how you do your job now. You're originally from Edmonton, not mm-hmm. even the hotbed it is now when it was that when you were coming through the pipeline. How did you get discovered? How did you end up on Mike Pressler and Duke's radar?
But complete fluke. Well, not complete fluke, but being in the right place at the right time certainly was a big part of it. So when I grew up in Alberta, there was no junior A lacrosse. There was just a senior B, junior B league. So when you were 15 years old, if you were playing junior B like I was, you would play against senior A teams or senior B teams with like 35-year-old men on the team. And there were just four teams in the province at the time. And it was different, certainly, than it is now. And if you were a high-level player and wanted to play junior A lacrosse, then you would have to go east or west. So I played my junior A lacrosse out in Burnaby. That's where I got to know Matt Brown, met a ton of great players out there, won a couple Minto Cups, and had just an awesome junior experience playing for Paul Del Monte and Dave Locke. So that was a tremendous learning experience for me, and definitely impacted my coaching acumen for sure.
But in terms of how you ended up at Duke, where did...
Oh, yeah, sorry, I forgot the tail end of that question. So at that point in time, there was no, like, club teams in Alberta. There was no travel teams. I played... Well, that's not true. We had a travel team, the Edmonton Miners, that would take one trip a year. And we'd go down and play some East Coast teams or some teams down in California once a year. I had to make the difficult decision to leave in July of the box season, miss some playoff games, which was not an easy decision to make at the time, in order to go and pursue this dream of playing college lacrosse. So I went down to Baltimore, me and another friend of mine from Canada, a good friend of mine named Peter Goot. We went to Baltimore and played at Champ Camp at Hopkins. And at the time, Champ Camp was only 16 teams. Most of them were the kind of MIAA and the IAC teams. There was a mishmash team of guys from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Florida, California, called Team USA. And I was placed on Team USA with my Canadian friend and this mishmash of guys. And we played in the tournament. I was playing attack at the time. And Coach Alberisi, who is now the head coach at Army, was the offensive coordinator at Duke. He was up at Hopkins to watch a different player on another team. And I had a good game, scored a bunch of goals, and was, a big, strong athlete. And he came down and talked to me after the game. I remember it very clearly. Coach Al was his very fit self at the time, and he came down and said, you know, Taylor, I like the way you played out there. First question he asked me was, how are your grades? And I said, I'm a good student, you know, 80s and 90s. And he said, well, do you know where Duke is? And I said, nope, I have no idea. He said, well, we'd like to start a conversation with you. So I was at one tournament. I was in the right place at the right time, and the process began from there.
So I lied. I said that that was the last question I was going to have about you directly, but I've got one more. We had to start this podcast about 5 minutes late because I was talking to Coach Pressler before we started this.
Oh, no
and
way.
I asked him, what's one thing about Taylor that I should slide into the conversation? And it's really a development question because he said, I changed that man's career when I took the short stick away from him and gave him a long pole. It's a dramatic example of player development, right? Changing positions. But how do you describe the way that you got better at Duke and how does that inform your approach obviously to coaching, right, day in, day out, 185 days a year, whatever the case may be when guys are on campus, relative to when you're recruiting and thinking about not who a player is going to be day one freshman year, but who he might be, you know, as a junior and a senior, that if he's not good enough as a freshman, might be good enough as a junior and a senior?
Yeah, well, first off, my career at Duke and the fact that I started, I began my career there as an attackman, a scout team attackman my freshman year, scored my first collegiate goal playing attack against Army. And then sophomore year.
Ironic, given where Coach Alberici is now.
Yeah, it is. Started kind of migrating towards the defensive end. Sophomore year, started playing a little bit of defensive midfield. Junior year was still in the mix in the midfield, but started playing more defensive midfield, man down midfield, face off wings and such. And then at the end of my junior year, Coach Presser said, "Hey, we need some more leadership at the defensive end. Would you consider picking up a pole?" And part of me wished he'd asked me that sooner because I think it suited my mentality as a player. You know, I think I could have thrived there had that transition happened earlier. But from a coaching perspective, you know, I spent a lot of years learning about offense and playing offense and learning how to coach offense. And I think that has definitely helped me to be a well-rounded coach, you know, learning from Coach Al about how to play attack and how emotion offense works and so on and so forth, I think has helped me to understand how defenses can put an offense in difficult situations. So I feel like I got a really well-rounded lacrosse coaching background from my experience at Duke. And when I look at players now, you know, I don't recruit midfielders with the intention of moving them to defense very often, but there certainly are some high school guys. We've had, you know, two guys come through here. We have a starter on our team right now, Ryan Bradley, who's a big 6'4", mobile, athletic, long stick midfielder who was a offensive midfielder until he got to St. Joe's. We recruited him to be an LSM, and he has thrived in that position. But I do think sometimes there are, when you have someone who's an athlete and a competitor, they find their way onto the field. Sometimes you have to create a role for them, but if they have those two elements, you got to find a way to work out a role for them. And I think we certainly evaluate our roster and our lineup that way.
So let's dive into the Hawks. One of the things that's really compelling about the story with respect to how you guys recruit is a little bit of a binary shift when it comes to the results. If you evaluate basically the period up to 6 years ago versus the last 6 years, it's pretty distinct in terms of the results that you've been able to achieve. What goes into that? What changed in terms of, you know, 8-9 years ago when you were recruiting the guys who have now been the contributors, the ones that have been leading to a roughly 72% winning percentage over the last 6 years?
Support from the university. So when I first started here, Don DeGiulia, who was the athletic director who hired me, you know, he was very candid and said, "We want to be great at lacrosse. You know, that decision's been made by the president, the board of trustees, and we're going to start, you know, moving things in that direction, adding scholarships, adding full-time coaching, assistant coaching positions, improve the budget, redo the locker room, stadium renovation, all of these things." And so that got us started. And that took, you know, that doesn't happen overnight. You know, it takes, you know, years for the infrastructure to be in place. During that first period, the rules were a little different with regard to how you could use your aid, both institutionally and from an NCAA rules perspective. I guess it would have been about 6 years ago, the NCAA changed their ruling on how you could combine academic, need-based, and athletic aid. And that was right around the time when we became a fully funded program. So we went to the full complement of athletic scholarships. The limitations on how we could combine those types of aid went away. And so we could provide some really attractive packages to some high-end students and some high-end players. And the first group that we recruited with the full complement of athletic scholarships and the ability to freely stack the three different types of aid was, you know, last year's fifth year class. So that's Levi Anderson, Matt Bomer, Colin Reich, Carter Page was in the next class. But these are guys who have really carried our program over the last few years. And, you know, that has paid dividends with the recruiting classes we've been able to yield since then. So that has been a big part of the upward trajectory.
So, and I want to be clear, it's not as if you weren't successful prior to it. I mean, you won your league, I believe, or at least finished first in the regular season or tied 3 years in a row, you know, before that kind of breakthrough season in 2018. What, obviously, so is a kind of a two-part question. The first part is, how, when you have a full complement of scholarships, does it change? It's very obvious how it would change your ability to close, right? If you're just constantly being outbid by programs who have more available scholarship dollars than you, then it's understandable what needs to change in order to be able to win those recruiting battles. But my question is actually a little bit more about how does it change how you evaluate and who you try to start conversations with? Basically, did you start to target a higher level player in conjunction with getting more available scholarship dollars because you had a suspicion that you were going to be able to win those battles?
I think those two things are they just so happen to come about at the same time. So our program had had some great seasons. You know, we had broken through into the top 20 in the middle of maybe the 2017-2018 season. So we were getting better right around the same time that the changes in terms of the aid and support that we could offer people happened. So, you know, as your program starts winning more games, people take notice, you can get access to a little bit different level of recruit. And now because of the aid you can provide, maybe you win a few more of those battles, right? And then because you won some of those battles, you continue to win more games and get more competitive with kind of the household names or the blue blood programs. And then, you know, if you go to the NCAA tournament, then all of a sudden that gives you access. You play on national TV, you get access to a different level of recruit. And I think, you know, the fact that we've been able to be in the NCAA tournament two of the last 3 years and be, you know, in and around the top 20 for each of the last 4 years has helped us to become more of an attractive opportunity as a place you can go and compete and win and play at the highest level. And that just happened to coincide with the time that we were receiving more funding and more freedom with the funding that we had.
I want to ask specifically about Levi's recruitment because there are two considerations that separate him from some others. So the first is, he's a star, right? And, you know, at the pro level, that has continued to be true. And then separately, he's from Alberta, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. It's also interesting given that that's where you're from. How did you find Levi? Who else was recruiting him when you were trying to land his commitment? And how did the process unfold?
So I've known Levi for a long time, since he was a younger kid, probably middle school aged. You know, Jeff Snyder, who runs the Elevate travel program and winter training and classroom program. Jeff has done an incredible job in Alberta growing the game and getting high-level instruction to some of the best players. So I learned about Levi through Jeff and through Elevate. And we had another player who's the same age as Levi who came a year earlier named Zach Manti, who was, you know, one of the top players in Alberta. And was a starter for us at the defensive midfield position and a two-time captain for us the year before Levi. Levi came down, played at Autumn Gold at Towson, I think maybe twice, 2 years in a row. I used to run a camp up in Alberta with Jeff where we'd bring some college coaches up there. So I got to know him over the years through those things. I think his final two that he was deciding between were us and Towson. And, you know, we were fortunate to have him come to St. Joe's because he made an immediate impact from the time he stepped foot on campus. And, you know, Levi is he's not a super outspoken guy. He's not like a guy who wants to be the center of attention. He's just an easygoing guy, a hardworking guy, and a really, you know, a super talented guy.
Continuing along the theme of geography, you mentioned that your roster is represented from players filled of players from all over the country. And there are hotbeds like Long Island or Baltimore or DC or certainly Philadelphia. But you've had maybe some outside success specifically in North and South Carolina. And it's, you know, interesting that you mentioned that there were players from North and South Carolina on that Team USA champ camp team that you were on. How do you describe that region of the country and what it's meant for your program?
Well, it's really been a big part of our success recruiting kids from the non-traditional areas. And so the way I would put it kind of into context is, you know, as you're trying to improve your program, sometimes there's this thought like, hey, you should go and recruit from these schools, like, you know, the Malverns, the Haverfords, the Chaminade, the St. Anthony's, you know, Loyola Blakefield, all of those places. But it's hard to get the best players from those types of places when you're not, at the time, a name brand program. And so you can fight it out and try and, you know, get in the running for the next tier of players from those places. But my experience has been that the best players from the non-traditional areas may not be as polished as some of the players at those types of programs, but they're every bit as good an athlete and can be developed. And so that's been a hallmark for our program, is developing players from non-traditional areas who possess the size, the speed, the athleticism, the skill, the IQ, but they just need to be coached at a little bit higher level. And so, you know, last year or 2 years ago, we had Matt Bomer, who was, you know, Matt Bomer broke the all-time scoring record at St. Joe's. There just happened to be another guy who broke it as well. But Matt Bomer is probably the most underrated player we've had in our program, four-time captain, and hails from Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, him and Levi from Calgary, Alberta, Carter from Peterborough, Colin Reich from Charleston, South Carolina, Austin Strazula from Vero Beach, Florida, Tucker Brown from Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. You know, this year, one of our best midfielders is from Denver, Colorado, Griffin Mallory. So we found guys all over the country. And for us, you know, sometimes it's easier to go and find the best player in a non-traditional area than trying to fight it out for that next tier of player from a place that everybody knows about.
I'm actually going to throw a moderate yellow flag on Griffin Mallory because he actually grew up locally here in Baltimore. And my guy, Dan Kaplan, who's sitting on the other side of this wall, coached him when he was little. And he wanted to make sure that he got a shout out for some of the value that he provided the program before he moved out and attended Valor Christian outside of Denver.
Yeah, that's awesome. Griff is a great guy. He's been an awesome leader for us so far this fall, and will continue to lead our team this spring.
So you brought up how the core of your roster for this run has really been extended by virtue of the additional years of COVID eligibility and some of the other injuries that might have cost guys years at the beginning of their career. What did that do in terms of how you approached recruiting the class of 2024? Did you know at that time in 2022 that you were likely to get these additional years, and as a result, that was the class that you were going to have to really emphasize, either whether it be scholarship allotment or roster spots, you know, kind of going heavier in? Or was that something that happened after you had already kind of recruited that class, so to speak, and so any type of adjustment would be made kind of on the fly?
I think it was more of the latter. I don't remember, you know, intentionally thinking like we need to recruit more right now or less right now, factoring in the fifth year guys. I think the COVID stuff has the COVID eligibility has created a situation where, you know, you had five classes on your team. I mean, last year we had 13 grad students. The year before we had 11. So you've got five classes on your team, which means, you know, it's going to be more difficult for freshmen in your lineup to get on the field. So a lot of those freshmen would not see game action. And my feeling on that is I didn't want to waste their year of eligibility by putting them into a couple of games. I'd rather save the year and give them the option to decide what they want to do, you know, in their fifth year, where chances are certainly higher that they would be impactful players for us down the road. So I don't really think there was anything intentional that we did. It just kind of was reactionary to the circumstances that came up.
So focusing a little bit more on this moment in time, we're recording this on Thursday, September 19th. You've yet to take a commitment from a player in the class of 2026. How do you describe your approach to post-September 1st, and what would be an ideal scenario for how you would go about building a class?
I think in every class, there's guys that you know more about, whether it's because, you know, they're top players in the class and they've got a lot of, you know, recognition and notoriety, or they're guys that you just happen to see more over the summer. And so I think ideally you'll have a couple of guys that you've built a relationship with, whether it was through camp or whether it was through just seeing their team play a bunch, that you can try and, you know, snatch up early in the recruiting process to kind of get your class started. And then you're sort of, you know, sifting through this first couple weeks where you're figuring out, okay, who's really interested in us and who are we really interested in? You know, I think everybody takes your calls. Everybody has been super polite. There's no one who, you know, in the first interaction is like, no, coach, I'm not interested. And then you start to, over the first week of September, figure out, okay, well, if I'm asking this guy to set a visit date or for a transcript or, you know, to catch up on the phone, and they're saying, oh, I'll get it to you later, or I'll get it to you down the road, well, you need to read between the lines. If someone is excited about your school, they'll want to get there right away. So, you know, your list starts to shrink pretty quickly as some of that sifting out process happens. Players have it the same way on their end. They get emails, texts, whatever. They think they have interest from these places, but then, you know, midway through the first week, there's no follow-up. And so now they're like, oh man, I thought I was getting recruited by these schools, but I've had no kind of, you know, continued correspondence with them. I guess I should circle back with these other schools who've been on me to set a visit date and get their transcript read and all of that stuff. So, you know, you hope that you can grab a couple guys that you know really well, that have a familiarity with the school, that, you know, fit the mold of what you're looking for right away. And then you're kind of trying to sift through the rest of it. You know, this month has been crazy. I mean, I think we've had like 28 or 29 visits to campus already in 2 weeks. So it's a little bit crazy, and some of it kind of blurs together. But I think in an ideal world, we'll get maybe three or four commitments by the end of this month, and then hopefully a couple more in October. And with some of the stuff that has potential to be coming down the road with House versus NCAA and roster limits and all of that, this will be a smaller class for us. So we'll probably take 10 or 11 guys in this group, which is smaller than we have in the past. So we're trying to, you know, get the core of the class together quickly and then make sure we're pretty targeted with kind of that second half of the class.
And that brings up a good place to go next, which is how valuable is November recruiting from the standpoint of, I guess, kind of three things: watching the players that you've already committed, getting a second look at the players that you know are interested and you might be interested in, you're keeping the conversation alive, but you're not quite certain that they're at the level you need them to be in order to take the commitment. And then thirdly, for discovering players you didn't even know about, now that you have this greater understanding of who's off the board and, you know, who basically who still has spots, right? So what does this market look like and who are the available players? And especially if it's, you know, a guy who was injured this summer and wasn't able to play and all of a sudden, you know, kind of pops for the first time because you haven't really seen him live ever.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you said there. And I'm kind of like torn with November recruiting because, you know, it can be really helpful in certain cases. And sometimes you're just watching some kids in some really difficult environments to play lacrosse, you know, whether it's because of how cold it is or it's because they haven't been playing lacrosse for, you know, a few weeks while they're focused on soccer or football season or whatever else they're doing in the fall. But I do think it does help to solidify certain evaluations on kids or, to solidify that, you know what, I need to move on. I need to find somebody else. And there are always guys who are injured during the summer who come back in the fall with a bit of a vengeance. And they're like, you know, they're pissed they missed September 1st and no one knew who they were. And they see their friends getting recruited. And so those guys sometimes come back and play with tremendous energy in November. So we've found new prospects every November. There's, you know, it's not an exact science. You can't see everybody that you want to see over the summer. And there's new players who pop up who jump on the list in November. There's guys who, you know, get crossed off the list in November. And there's guys who you say, all right, I have seen what I need to see. This is the guy for us. We got to try and get him and get him quickly here before the end of the year.
Canada. You mentioned that it's been an important source of talent and production for you. It's also becoming more competitive, I assume, or at least I've been told. Matt Brown said that on the podcast a couple weeks ago.
I 100% agree with Matt on that. It is. It used to be kind of like this untapped resource, and if you had connections, you could get an in. It is not nearly as untapped as it used to be.
So how has that informed how you go about it?
I think, well, it's more difficult to get the best kids, you know, not more difficult to see the best kids, more difficult to recruit them because everyone is recruiting them now. I think having a connection with the coaches up there, I think having people up there whose sons are playing lacrosse, who have friends who played with me or know me personally, I think definitely helps. I think when you're recruiting someone who's looking at two different schools and coaches and one of the coaches, they have friends or advisors in their corner saying, I know that this guy will take care of your son. You can trust that, I think has helped us. It is interesting. A lot of the guys that I played with now back home and in the NLL over the years, there's a lot of guys whose kids are getting to be recruitable age. So hopefully I can use that to my advantage and, get almost like, you know, I feel like 15, 20 years ago, and it's still like this to some degree for Syracuse, but anybody in upstate New York who played at Syracuse or had a kid or a dad who played at Syracuse, it was like they got first right of refusal, you know, and hopefully we can keep something like that going here with the Canadian guys at St. Joe's as some of the guys who know me and I played with start to have kids who are looking at great places to play college lacrosse.
You brought up friends, and it just sparks a notion in my mind. I would imagine that over the course of Kevin Kisisi's tenure, there were a lot of kids that were looking at Lehigh and St. Joe's. And I would imagine that right now, there are a lot of guys that look at Richmond and St. Joe's, and you're friends with Dan Shamati as well, two teammates from when you were Blue Devils. What's it like to recruit against a friend? I can imagine what it's like to play against a friend. I've done that. But recruiting is a little different in terms of,
well,
like,
I just badmouth them to everybody. So that's my strategy. It is funny recruiting against your friends. Like, you know, I've had half a dozen guys come to St. Joe's and they're either heading to Denver to meet with Matt or they're heading to Richmond or they're stopping by Virginia. Obviously, Virginia a little different than Lehigh in terms of who they're recruiting and who we're competing against. But yeah, we saw it a lot with Lehigh. We saw it, see it all the time now with Richmond, you know, to some degree, certainly with Denver. But it's fun. You know, you hope you can win some of those battles. You win some, you lose some. There's no hard feelings. The one thing I do like about, you know, when we get a commitment from someone that I'm close with is I feel like, you know, in recruiting and with recruiting committed guys, I know that there are certain guys that would not recruit one of my committed players. I feel like when you do that, you're basically saying, I know it's a business, I know it's a job, but we're not close enough friends that I care about that. And so that's fine. But with the guys I'm closest with, who I know, they know that I'm loyal to them, and that loyalty is a two-way street. It does help, you know, they're not going to come calling after your guys.
That's an interesting point. What about when it goes to sitting on the sidelines? Do you ever, like, I would imagine you want to sit next to your friends because you want to catch up and whatever. But at the same time, when you're sitting next to your cohort of programs where, right, we're all watching the same thing. We're all taking in the same information. Do you kind of relish the opportunities when you can be separated from, whether it's like I'm recruiting on a sideline that is exclusively Division III programs, or I'm recruiting on a sideline that nobody's on, or I'm recruiting on a sideline that is exclusively, you know, ACCs, right? Like, I don't even know if that exists, but you get my point. Like, is there a value in trying to feel like I'm the one that's taking in whatever's being seen right here? And as long as it's good, I get the advantage because nobody, you know, I'm not competing against the other guys that are going to be coming after the players in this field.
Yeah, I do. I do. So a couple things I'll mention there. As long as the field conditions are good, sometimes I'll go sit at a field where I don't see 40 coaches sitting because I think, you know, everybody is going to see the same thing there. If I go sit at this other field, maybe I'll see someone or something that nobody else sees. So sometimes I'll just go and sit, you know, at, you know, not the main turf field, go down, find a grass field that's decent condition. And, you know, I'll sit there for the day and see if I can pick up something that, you know, the other coaches aren't all going to be watching. In terms of sitting next to your friends, I think the guys who are my friends would say, I hate it when T-Ray comes and sits next to me because I'm not going to get any work done. You know, I sit next to the guys I know. I'll sit next to Kevin if I see him. I'll sit next to Dan if he's there. Coach Scudder, Will Scudder, played for me and Kevin at Lehigh and is now taken over there. So I enjoy sitting next to those guys. Coach Natalin at Towson's a good friend of mine. So you really do have a lot of people that you enjoy their company. I look forward to going recruiting in the summer when you haven't seen everybody. You're all kind of in your own little silos worrying about your season and your program. And then, you know, the summer hits. You're like, oh, I can't wait to go to this event. I'm going to see, you know, all of these guys that I haven't had a chance to see and really talk to in a while. So I do look forward to that part of it.
As we start to wind down the conversation, I think there are a couple of things that I wanted to briefly touch on just with respect to developing relationships with high school juniors and their families as you go through the process. How does it start? What are the things that you care about in terms of what you want them to know about you? And what are the most important things that you want to learn about them?
I think it's important to get the kids talking as much as you can. So I'll generally start the conversation by asking them to tell me about themselves and their family. You know, do they come from a big family? Are they an only child? You know, what do they do in their spare time? And try and get to know them a little bit that way. I like to try and understand what motivates them, why they think they want to play Division I lacrosse. You know, it's a big commitment. Everyone has their own reasons for wanting to do it, but I like to hear them verbalize why they want to do this and what gets them excited about potentially being a college lacrosse player. You know, I think in terms of getting to know me and our program, I think I want them to understand what it's going to be like to play here at St. Joe's. I don't beat around the bush. I tell people it's going to be really hard. We are a program that relies on hard work and grit, as all programs do, but hard work, grit, and player development are at the core of what we're going to do. So if you like to practice hard, if you like to be pushed in the weight room, if you like daily competition, then you'll like being a part of our program. If you don't like that stuff, this is the wrong place for you. And every coach will say that because it's important at every program. But I talked to him about how many competition days we have in the year in Division I lacrosse. You get 17 competition days. You know, we're training 5-6 days a week every week you're on campus. You know, most of what we do is preparation for those competitions. Does that sound exciting to you? Or are you like, oh, man, I don't like practice? Well, if you don't like to practice, you don't like to train, this is not the right place for you, because I loved those things as a player, and I want to coach players that love those things, that love to compete with their teammates every day in everything that they do. And so I think I want them to know that about me. I think I want them to spend time with the guys on our team, because I do think I have a good relationship with the players on our team, and they'll tell you, yeah, Coach Ray can get on you, and he can make your life a challenge, but he really cares about you, and he enjoys having fun with you. I think our staff in general has a very good sense of humor, and while we're pushing you to be your best, we're also going to be able to make you laugh and have some fun doing it. And so I just want them to figure out if they feel like me and my staff are going to be adults that they will be comfortable around and enjoy being around at practice each day.
Do your players call you Tank, or is that a nickname that was left behind from college?
That's a nickname that was left behind from college. You remember the Matrix? Original Matrix. There was two brothers in that movie who like ran the spaceship, and they were Tank and Dozer. Well, I have a brother, Devin, who played with me at Duke as well. Devin is he's shaped more like a bulldozer. He's 5'10", 210 in college. Not a heavy guy, but a thick athlete. And so we became Tank and Dozer in college.
That's an incredible note to end on. Taylor Ray, you said that you and your staff like to have fun. They have a good sense of humor. That's a perfect – I mean, your name is Taylor, Taylor Tank, Devin Dozer. It was perfect. Yep. It was very topical.
Yep. It was it suited the two of us, I think.
We really appreciate your time. All the insight. It was an incredible look at the program on Hawk Hill. Really admire what you've done and what the program's achieved under your leadership. Wish you the best of luck as you go about recruiting this class of 26 and certainly continue with the fall work with your team on campus. And can't wait to see St. Joe's when they get back and the games count in February.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me on, and keep up the great work.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.